physical and verbal reassurances are mostly wasted on me. I cannot feel your touch, and I find your simple affirmations to be the result of you reinforcing your desired worldview, rather than a fully evidenced examination of the topic. I don't know what you are, Embot, I said. You're not a monster, but I'm not sure you're a robot either. Again, do you have any evidence of these suppositions? I trust you, I said again. Does that make you feel better? It shouldn't, he said. Why are we pretending? I simply imitate feelings in order to better. Do you feel better? Yes. Proof, I said. Feelings aren't proof. Feelings are the opposite of proof. Not when the thing you're trying to prove is someone's humanity. I smiled, then ducked under the tarp. I'd left some slack near the cockpit, and pushed my way over so I could reach inside. What do we do with the drone if you can't program it? I can program it, Embot said. It will simply have a basic, routine set of programs. No personality, no simulated emotions. A machine. That will do, I said. Keep working on it. I gave Doomslug a scratch on her head and picked her up, then gathered the parts I'd taken off Embot and walked back down into my bedroom. Embot put my next task onto the screen there. I needed to combine the sensor unit, the holographic unit, and the jamming array into a single box he'd ordered. I set to work, following Embot's instructions. It took less time than I'd expected. All that was left was to wire it in such a way that we could attach it to the bottom of the drone. It would hang down like a fruit from a branch, not particularly elegant in design, but it would let the drone activate camouflage, record what it saw, and hide from sensor sweeps. Theoretically, I'd be able to let it loose in the bathroom of the weights and measures, then leave it to carefully make its way, invisibly, to engineering and take some photos of the place. Embot was skeptical that simple photos would be enough and had insisted that we include an entire sensor unit to measure things like radiation. But I had an instinct, perhaps related to my abilities. I was close to figuring something out. A secret related to cytonics and how the superiority used them. If I could just see those hyperdrives. Spensa, Embot said. Someone is at the door downstairs. I looked up from my wiring, frowning. Is it Chamwit? I'll need to send her away. Maybe tell her to go on vacation for a few days. We can't risk Kuna finding out. It's not her, Embot said, showing me an image from the door camera. It was Morimer. Why were they here? I hadn't even realized they knew where I lived. I'll deal with them, I said. Chapter 28. By now, I was starting to figure out Dione facial expressions. For example, the way they would draw their lips to a line, showing no teeth, was something like a smile to them. It indicated they were pleased and non-aggressive. Morimer, I asked from the doorway, is everything all right?
Everything is well, Alanik, they said. As well as it can be, considering we aren't flying. Didn't you once say you hated the idea of days off?
Yeah, I said.
I can't prove myself when I'm not flying, Morimer said. It leaves me worried. I don't have much time left, but it isn't like I want to have to be forced to fight a Delver. Should I want something catastrophic to occur just so I can prove I'm worth being me?
I think like that too, I said, lingering by the door. Like, I wanted so badly to fly on my home planet that I hoped some kind of attack would happen so I could fight it. But at the same time, I didn't. Morimer gestured in agreement, then just stood there. I might have been learning their facial expressions, but Dione body language was still hard for me to read. Was Morimer nervous? What was this about?
This is awkward, isn't it? They finally said. Alanik, I need to talk to you. I need to know, straight out. Is this charade worth continuing?
I felt a spike of panic. They knew. How could they know?
I'd worried about Vapor seeing through my disguise, or maybe a confrontation with Braid, but never Mortimer. I wasn't ready. Am I worth continuing to train? Mortimer said. Is it worth pretending that I belong in the flight? Should I just give up? Wait. Wait, no. They didn't know about me. I stilled my nerves and forced myself to smile, an expression that made Mortimer wince. Right. Showing teeth was aggressive to them. You're great, Mortimer, I said honestly. Really? Considering how long you've been flying, you're an excellent pilot. Really? Really, I said. I hesitated, then stepped out of the building. I didn't want to invite them in, not while I was in the middle of my secret project. You want to talk? Let's take a walk. You're from the city, right? Yes, Mortimer said. They seemed more relaxed as they continued. Both of my parents lived here all their lives. There's an excellent water garden not far from here. Come, I'll show you. I locked the door, then tapped a message on my bracelet, using DDF flight code to explain to Embot. Going on walk, nothing wrong, back soon. Mortimer drew their lips to another calm line, and I noticed that the right half of them was redder than it had been a few days ago. I wondered if that was confirmation that Mortimer was getting closer to being born. Though, was born even the right word? They beckoned me with an understated wave of the hand, the palm up, a Dione gesture distinctly different from the yell or a wave that someone from Detritus might have used. I started along the walkway with them, entering the flood of creatures that were always moving along these streets. The constant presence of all these people made me feel trapped. I'd felt the same way sometimes back in Igneous. That was part of why I'd fled into the caverns to explore. I hated always being surrounded by people, hated walking shoulder to shoulder. Mortimer barely seemed to notice it. They walked beside me, hands clasped behind their back, as if trying very hard to be unassuming. Nobody on the walkway gave the flight suits much of a second glance. Back on Detritus, people noticed pilots and made way for them. Here we were just two more strange faces in a sea of oddities. This is good, Mortimer told me. This is what friends do. Go out together. You say that like it's a new experience for you. It is, Mortimer said. 2 months of life is not so long, and, well, to be honest, I do not find the process of bonding to be easy. My right parent is very good at it, making friends and talking to people, but that is not an attribute this version of me seems like it will inherit. Scud, I said. I'm going to be blunt, Mortimer. The way you say that hurts my brain. You remember some things your parents knew, but not all of it? Yes, Mortimer said. And the baby I become will remember the same, a mix of both parents, with many holes to fill in with my own experiences. Of course, that mixture might change based on how many times we pupate. You say that so frankly, I said. I don't like the idea of society modifying someone before they're born. It's not society, Mortimer said. It's my parents. They simply want to find a personality for me that will have the best chance for success. But if they decide to try again, instead of having you, it's kind of the same thing as you dying. No, not really, Mortimer said, cocking their head. And even if it were, I can't really be killed. I'm a hypothetical personality, not a final one. They puckered their lips, a Dione sign of discomfort. I do want to be born. I think I would make an excellent pilot, and this program shows that we need pilots, right? So it's not so terrible that maybe a Dione will be born who likes to fight? It sounds like something your people need, I said, stepping around a flowing creature with two large eyes, but which otherwise looked like nothing so much as a living pile of mud. See, this is the problem. If society is certain that unaggressive people are the best, only those kinds of children get born, and then they perpetuate that kind of thinking. so nobody ever gets born who contradicts the standard. Mortimer looked down. I heard what you and Hesho said yesterday, on the weights and measures, while we were flying home. At first, I thought they meant the conversation about hyperdrives, and I panicked for a second, before remembering the earlier one where we'd complained about the superiority and the Dions, their elite, snobby ways, presuming to be above us lesser species. I know that you dislike the superiority, Mortimer said. You consider working with us to be a chore, a necessary evil. But I wanted you to know that the superiority is wonderful, too. Maybe we are too elitist, too unwilling to look at what other species give us. But this platform, and dozens like it, have existed for hundreds of years in peace. The superiority gave my parents good lives. It gives millions of beings good lives. By controlling hyperdrives, we prevent so much suffering. There haven't been any major conflicts since the human wars. If a species gets rowdy or dangerous, we can just leave them to themselves. It's not so bad. We don't owe them our technology, particularly if they're not going to be peaceful. Mortimer led us down several streets, past a multitude of shops and buildings with signs that I couldn't read. I tried not to be overwhelmed by it all, tried not to look like I was watching each and every one of these strange creatures. But I couldn't help it. What secrets did they hide behind those faces that were trying far too hard to pretend to be pleasant? What about people who complain or don't fit with your society? I asked. What happens to them? That person who was protesting out in front of the docks, where are they now? Exile is the fate of many who make trouble, Mortimer said. But again, do we owe species the right to live on our stations? Can't you focus on all the individuals we're helping instead of the few that we can't figure out how to fit? It seemed to me that the ones who didn't fit were the most significant, the real measure of what it was like to live in the superiority. Besides, I kept repeating to myself the most important fact, that these people had suppressed and tried to exterminate mine. I didn't know the whole story, but from what Gran-Gran had said, my direct ancestors on the Defiant hadn't taken part in the main war. They'd been condemned simply for being humans, and had been chased until they'd crashed on Detritus. Braid hadn't caused a war, but the superiority treated her like cavern slime. It made it hard to think about the good the government did when I found the exceptions so very blatant. We walked farther, and I kept my arms pulled tight at my sides, because if I bumped someone, they apologized to me. All this false kindness, hiding their destructive ways. All this strangeness. Even Mortimer himself was an example of it. They were two people who had grown together by pupating, like a caterpillar. Two people imitating a third person. How could I hope to understand such a people as this? I was supposed to act like this was normal? We walked around a corner, passing two Krell. Even still, whenever I saw one of them, the hair stood up on the back of my neck and a chill passed through me. The images of their armor had been used in defiant iconography since before I'd been born. Can you feel them? I found myself asking Mortimer as we passed the Krell. Your parents? Kind of, Mortimer said. It is difficult to describe. I'm made up of them. In the end, they will decide whether to give birth or whether to pupate and try again. So they're watching, and they're conscious, but at the same time, they are not. Because I am using their brains to think, as I am using their melded bodies to move. Scud. It was just so, well, alien. We turned around a wall, stepping through an archway into the garden that Mortimer had been leading me to. I froze in place and gaped. I'd been imagining some streams and maybe a waterfall, but the water garden was something far more grand. Enormous, shimmering globs of water, easily a meter across, floated above the ground. They undulated and reflected light, hanging some 2 meters or more in the air. Below, smaller globs emerged from spigots in the ground and floated upward as well, merging or splitting apart. Children of 100 different species ran through the park, chasing the bubble-like chunks of water. It was like zero-G, but only for the water. Indeed, when children would catch a glob of water and slap it, it would splash into 1,000 smaller globs that rippled, catching light. I ate lunch in the cockpit each day during training, and was quite familiar with how odd it could be to drink in zero-G. I'd sometimes squeeze a glob of water out to hover in front of me, then stick my lips into it and suck it down. This was the same thing, only on an enormous scale. It was gorgeous.
"Come," Mortimer said. "It's my favorite place in the city. Just be careful. The water might splash on you."
We stepped into the park and followed a path between spigots. The children didn't all smile and laugh. Dionnes had their characteristic lax, non-threatening expressions, while other species would howl. One very pink child I passed was making a hiccuping sound. Yet, seeing them together, their joy was palpable. Varied though they were all having fun. "How do they do this?" I asked, reaching out and tapping a bubble of water as it passed. It shook in the air, vibrating, looking a little like the way the sound of a deep drum felt.
"I'm not sure entirely," Mortimer said. "It has something to do with specific uses of artificial gravity and certain ionizations."
Mortimer bowed their head. I was pretty sure that was a Dionne method of shrugging.
"My parents came here often. I inherited a love of the place from both. Here, come sit. See that timer over there? This is the best part."
We settled onto a bench, Mortimer leaning forward, watching a timer on the far side of the park. Most of this ground was a stone patio, without much ornamentation other than pathways of a light blue rock lined with benches. When the timer on the far wall hit zero, all of the water bubbles in the air burst and came crashing down in a sudden rain, which made the playing children squeal and laugh and excitedly call out to each other and their parents. I found the sounds transfixing.
"My parents met here," Mortimer said, "about 5 years ago. They'd been coming as children for many years, but it wasn't until they were just out of training that they actually started talking to each other."
"And they decided to pair?"
"Well, first they fell in love," Mortimer said.
It was obvious. Of course, the Dionnes could love. Even though it was hard to imagine something as human as love existing between these creatures who were so strange. A few Krell children ran past, wearing smaller suits of armor with 2 extra legs, perhaps to make it easier for the young crab-like creatures to keep balanced upright. They waved arms wildly with excited joy. This is the superiority, I told myself. Those are Krell. They're trying to destroy my people. Stay angry, Spensa. But these children couldn't lie. Perhaps the adults could keep up a charade like I imagined everyone here doing. The children killed that idea. For the first time since arriving, I let my guard drop. Those children were just children. The people walking through the park, even the Krell, weren't all plotting my destruction. They probably didn't even know about detritus. They were people. They were all just people, with strange carapaces or odd life cycles. They lived and they loved. I looked at Mortimer, whose eyes were glistening with an emotion that I instantly understood. Fondness. A person remembering something that made them happy. They didn't smile. They made the Dionne thin-lipped expression. But it was the same somehow. Oh, saints and stars. I couldn't keep up the warrior act any longer. These weren't my enemies. Some parts of the superiority were, of course, but these people, they were just people. Mrs. Chamwit probably wasn't a spy, but was instead really just a kindly housekeeper who wanted to see me fed. And Mortimer, they just wanted to be a pilot. Mortimer just wanted to fly, like me.
You're an excellent pilot, I told them. Really, you have picked up on all this so quickly, it's incredible.
I don't think you should give up. You need to fly to prove to the superiority that people like you are needed.
Are we, though? Mortimer asked. Are we really?
I looked up, watching globes of water rise, undulating into the air. I listened to the children of 100 species and their joyful noises. I know a lot of stories, I said, about warriors and soldiers from the Katameek, my people's version of holy books. Embot had been briefing me on terms from Alanik's people that I should try to sprinkle into my conversation. My grandmother would tell these tales to me. Some of my first memories are of her voice calmly telling me about an ancient warrior standing against the odds.
Those days are behind us, though, Mortimer said. In the superiority, at least. Even our training against the Delvers is just a hypothetical, a plan for something that will probably never happen. All the real wars are done, so we have to plan for the maybe halfway implausible conflicts.
If only they knew. I closed my eyes as water splashed down, causing children to squeal. Those old stories have a lot of different themes, I said. One, I never quite understood until I started flying. It happens in the epilogues, the stories after the stories. Warriors who have fought return home, but find they no longer belong. The battle has changed them, warped them, to the point where they are strangers. They protected the society they love, but in doing so made themselves into something that could never again belong to it.
That's depressing.
It is, but it isn't, all at once. Because they may have changed, but they still won. And no matter how peaceful the society, conflict always finds it again. During those days of sorrow, it's the aged soldier, the one who was bowed by battle, who can stand and protect the weak. You don't fit in, but you're not broken, Mortimer. You're just different. And they're going to need you someday. I promise it. I opened my eyes and looked to them, trying to give the Dione version of a smile with lips pressed tight.
Thank you, they said. I hope you're right. And yet at the same time, I hope you aren't.
Welcome to the life of a soldier. A thought struck me, a stupid one, maybe, but I had to try. I just wish my people could help more. I've been invited to try out as a pilot because some parts of your government recognize that they need us. I think my people could be your people's warriors.
Maybe, Mortimer said. I don't know that we'd want to put that burden on your people.
I think we'd be fine, I said. All we'd really need to know is how to hyperjump. You know, so we could properly protect the galaxy.
Ah, I see what you're doing, Alanik. But there's no use. I don't know how it works. I have no memories from either parent explaining the secret of hyperjumps. Even we aren't told. Otherwise, hostile aliens could just kidnap us and try to get the secret.
I grimaced. I guess I was kind of obvious, wasn't I?
You needn't feel bad, Mortimer said. I'd be worried if you didn't want to know the secret. Just trust me, you don't want it. Hyperjumps are dangerous. The technology is best entrusted to those who know what they're doing.
Yeah, I suppose. We started back, and from my limited ability to read Dione's, I felt like Mortimer's mood was far improved. I should have felt likewise, but each step I took reinforced to me the stark truth I'd finally confronted. We humans weren't at war with an all-powerful, terrible, nefarious force of evil. We were at war with a bunch of laughing children and millions, if not billions, of regular people. And Scud. I'd just talked one of their pilots into staying on the job. This place was doing strange things to my emotions and my sense of duty.
I'm glad you're in our flight, Alanik, Mortimer told me as we stepped up to the embassy. I think you might have the right amount of aggression. I can learn from you.
Don't be so sure, I said. I might be more aggressive than you think. I mean, my people did live with the humans for many years.
Humans can't be happy, though, Mortimer said. They don't understand the concept. Even Braid indicates this is true if you listen to her. Without proper training, humans are just mindless killing machines. You are so much more. You fight when you need to, but enjoy floating bursts of water when you don't. If I prove myself to my family, it will be because I show them that I can be like you.
I suppressed a sigh, opening the door. Doomslug sat on the ledge just inside, impatient for my return. Scud. Hopefully Mortimer wouldn't.
What is that? Mortimer demanded.
They were baring their teeth in a strange look of aggression and hatred. I stepped inside. It's my pet slug. Nothing to worry about.
Mortimer pushed into the door in a very forward manner, making me scoop up Doomslug and cradle her, backing away.
Mortimer closed the door most of the way, then peeked back out the crack. They spun on me.
Did you get permission to bring a venomous animal into Starsight? Do you have a license?
No, I said. I mean, I didn't ask.
You need to destroy the thing, Mortimer said. That's a Tanix. They're deadly.
I looked down at Doomslug, who fluted questioningly. It's not a Tanix, I promised. Different species entirely. They just look similar. I hold her all the time and nothing has happened to me.
Mortimer grimaced again.
Looking at me holding Doomslug protectively, however, they pushed their lips back to a line.
Just don't show it to anyone else, all right? You could get into serious trouble, even if it's not a Tanix.
They stepped back out the door.
Thank you for being a friend, Alanik. If I should end up being born with a different personality, well, I like the idea of having known you first.
I locked the door after they left.
You shouldn't come down here, I scolded Doomslug. Honestly, how did you even get down all those steps?
I carried her back up to my room, where I put her on the bed, then closed that door and locked it too, for no good reason.
Spencer, Embot said. You're back. What happened? What did they want?
I shook my head and sat down by the window, looking out at all those people. I'd been so determined to see them as my enemies. It had kept me focused. For some reason, though, I found the idea that they were indifferent to be even more frightening.
Spencer, Embot finally said again. Spencer, you should see this.
I frowned, turning toward the monitor on the wall. Embot switched it to a news station. It showed an image of detritus from space, with a caption underneath. Human scourge, close to escaping its prison. Chapter 29. It was detritus. The planet's enormous metal layers spun around it slowly in the void, lit by a sun I'd rarely seen. My breath caught. The screen scrolled news feeds across the bottom, but a Dione was doing a voiceover as well. My pin translated their words.
These stunning shots were smuggled back from an anonymous worker who claims to have been stationed at the human preserve for some time now.
The image cut to a close-up of defiant starfighters engaged in a dogfight with Krell drones. Flashing destructors lit up the void near the ever-watchful defense platforms.
This seems proof, the reporter said, that the human problem is not confined to the past as once thought. Our anonymous source says that containment of the humans has been bungled by an increasingly lax Department of Protective Services. The source cites key problems as being poor oversight and a failure to properly deploy suppression tactics. As you can easily see from this footage, the human infestation has begun to overwhelm defenses.
The screen cut to a shot of Winzik standing calmly behind a podium. The voiceover from the reporter continued.
Superiority Minister of Protective Services, Ose Bertam Winzik, insists that the risk is overblown.
This strain of humans, said Winzik, remains fully contained. We have no evidence that they know how to escape their system, which is light years from any other inhabited planet. The administration is working carefully to eliminate any danger these humans pose, but we assure you, the threat has been greatly exaggerated by the press.
I walked up to the screen, stumbling over some boxes, unable to tear my eyes away from the video of another set of dogfighting ships. Was that me? Yes, from the fight I'd engaged in right before saving Alanik's ship from crashing.
This news has started popping up on all the channels, Embot said. It seems that one of the Varvax who worked on the space station took secret videos over the last few months, then came to Starsight and leaked them.
Leaked them, I said. How does that work? Can't the government just stop the news programs from playing this video? They suppress any mention of how hyperdrives work.
It gets complicated, Embot said. I believe that the government could exile the person who took this video, but they can't legally do anything about the stations that are now showing it. At least, not without specific actions that have to pass through their Senate first.
How odd. I narrowed my eyes as Winzik came on the screen again. Kuna had told me about this. The Department of Protective Services tended to use flare-ups of human rebellion as a way of securing funds. Was that what they were doing here? It seemed these images were making everyone question Winzik and his department, though. Perhaps this leak really was an accident. I leaned forward as the screen swapped to an image of a seated Krell with a light pink exoskeleton. Embot read the banner at the bottom, which named them Sisme, Human Species Expert.
This administration has always been too lenient with dangerous species, the expert said, waving their hands in the animated way of the Krell. This infestation of humans is a bomb waiting to explode. And the fuse was lit the moment the Third Human War ended and human refuges were created. The government has worked hard to pretend that containment is absolute, but the truth is now leaking.
Excuse me if I'm wrong, an interviewer said from off-screen, but weren't we forced to preserve the humans because of mandated conservation of cultures and societies?
An outdated law, the expert said. The need to preserve the cultures of dangerous species must be balanced against the need to protect the peaceful species of the superiority.
The crab-like Krell waved to the side, and the camera zoomed out, showing a young human man sitting at a table. He remained in place, saying nothing as the expert continued.
You can see here a licensed and monitored human. Though many people are frightened of their fearsome reputation, in truth, humans are no more dangerous than the average lesser species. They are aggressive, yes, but not on the level of, say, a Cormac's drone or the Rexians. The danger of humans comes from their unusual mix of attributes, including the fact that their physiology creates a large number of cytonics. Normally, by the time a species has cultivated cytonics and early hyperdrive capacity, they have also found their way to a peaceful society. Humans are aggressive, industrious, and most importantly, quick to spread, capable of surviving in extreme environments. This is a deadly combination.
So, the interviewer said, how do you think this infestation should be dealt with?
Exterminate it, the expert said.
The camera cut to a shot of the interviewer, a Dione who, best I could judge, looked utterly horrified by the idea.
Barbaric, they exclaimed, standing up. How could you even suggest such a thing?
It would be barbaric, the expert said calmly, if we were talking about a race of intelligent beings. But the humans of this particular planet, they're more insects than people.
It is obvious that the detritus refuge has failed in its purpose, and for the good of all the galaxy, it must be cleansed.
The expert gestured to the human beside him.
Besides, this man is proof that the human species will not end if we destroy one rogue planet.
Humans can coexist with the superiority, but they must not be allowed to self-govern. It was foolish to attempt to keep Detritus. And for the record, I don't accept the excuses that the administration gives for why the humans were allowed access to technology in the first place. This talk of keeping them focused by providing space battles to engage them? Nonsense. The administration is making excuses to cover up an uncontrolled explosion of human aggression that began some 10 years ago. High Minister Ved should have listened to the advice of experts such as myself and dealt with the humans more harshly.
I sank down into the seat as the report returned to playing the recorded dogfights. I'd lived my entire life knowing that the Krell were trying to exterminate us. But to hear someone speak of us this way, so dispassionately. At my request, MBOT changed the station to another, which had a panel of experts talking. Another channel showed the same footage. The more I watched, the more small I felt. The way these news people spoke stole something precious from me. It reduced my entire people, our heroism, our deaths, our struggles, to an outbreak of pests. I walked to the window again. No chaos in the streets. People streaming in and out of their shops, going about their lives. Oddly, even as I found it difficult to summon my hatred for them, I did feel a growing hatred for the government that ruled them. The government hadn't just killed my father. Now they made him out to be some insect to be swatted. Tiny, a part of me thought, looking out at the people flowing on those streets. All so tiny. The superiority thought they were so grand. They too were just insects, biting bugs, an itching noise that needed to be silenced. Why were these pests snapping at me? It would take barely a thought to smother them all, and what was I thinking? I lurched back from the window, feeling sick. I felt the eyes watching me all around and somehow understood them. Those thoughts about insects were their thoughts. Something was happening to me. Something related to the Delvers, the Nowhere, and my abilities. MBOT worried he was the shadow. But he had no idea. I looked at the desk where I'd been working. There sat the casing, perhaps as large as a human head, where I'd attached the three components I'd taken out of MBOT. I seized it and stomped out of my room, leaving Doomslug to trill questioningly after me. I climbed onto the roof, then crawled under the tarp that hid MBOT. The drone lay where I'd left it, sitting on my seat in his cockpit, attached to the console by wires. "How much longer?" I asked him, "until you're done programming it." "I'm finished," MBOT said. "I was done not long after you left the house with Morimer. I would like a day to run it through diagnostic tests." "No time," I said. "Show me how to hook this piece I built onto the bottom." He popped a set of instructions up on his monitor, and I worked quietly, affixing wires and screwing my makeshift sensor bundle onto the bottom of the reprogrammed drone. "I am monitoring 80 different superiority channels," MBOT noted. "Many of them are talking about Detritus." I kept working. "Most of the people talking on these shows are angry, Spencer," he said. "They're making an outcry for stronger measures to be used against your people." "What stronger measures could they make than parking a fleet of battleships on our doorstep?" I asked. "I'm running simulations, and none of the outcomes are good." MBOT paused. "Your people need hyperdrives. The only way to escape such an overwhelming force is to run." I held up the drone, then activated it. The two small acclivity rings began to glow with a deep blue color underneath the wings, holding the thing in the air somewhat precariously with the large sensor module attached to the bottom. "Drone," I asked, "are you awake?" "Integrated AI install successful," the drone said in a monotone voice. "How are you feeling?" "I do not understand how to answer that question," it said. "It's not alive," MBOT said,
Or, well, it's not whatever I am.
Drone, I said. Engage active camouflage. It vanished, projecting a hologram onto its exterior that made it look like I was seeing through it. That plus the sensor scrambler should hide it from all but the most dedicated scan.
Active camouflage has weaknesses, Mbot noted. It's impossible to properly make something invisible from all angles using this kind of technology. Look at it from the side, then have it move.
I twisted around and he was right. From the side, the invisibility wasn't nearly as convincing. There was a ripple in the air, marking where the drone was. When it moved, the ripple was more noticeable.
Our best chance of having it remain unseen is for it to hover up high where nobody will accidentally run into it, Mbot said. Then we have it move slowly, with orders to freeze if anyone looks directly at it. If only one person is glancing at it, the drone can adapt to their perspective and remain hidden. The more people looking at it from different angles, the worse it will stand out.
Can it obey those orders? I asked.
Yes, it has basic intelligence, and I copied over a large chunk of my stealth infiltration protocols. It should be able to explore, take pictures of the area we want it to, then return to its hiding place for pickup.
Mbot paused again.
It can fly by itself, something I cannot do. Perhaps I shouldn't have said it wasn't alive, for in some ways, it is more alive than I am.
I thought about that, then opened the compartment on the side of the cockpit and took out the small emergency destructor pistol I kept there. Drone, I said. Deactivate hologram. It appeared just above me, hovering near the open canopy and the tarp draped around Mbot outside. I made sure the destructor pistol safety was activated, then secured it with electrical tape to the back of the drone so I could smuggle it in as well.
If you get into too much trouble, Mbot said, remember that you have a second face programmed into your bracelet. You can become someone else if Alanik gets compromised and you need to hide.
All right, I said.
Let's hope it doesn't come to that.
But in any case, Detritus is running out of time. We're going to have to try this plan tomorrow.
Part 4. Interlude. Jorgen spent his day learning how to make bread. Spence's grandmother was very good at bread, despite the fact that she was blind. Together they sat in her cramped single-room home in Igneous. Spence's mother had accepted new quarters, but her grandmother had insisted she remain here. She claimed she liked the feel of it. Red light flooded in through the window, and the air smelled of heat from the apparatus. You could smell heat, Jorgen had realized, or at least hot metal. It was a burned sort of smell, but not a burning smell. The smell of things that had gone so far beyond being on fire that now their ashes were stewing. Gran-Gran made him work like her, by touch and smell alone. He closed his eyes, reaching out and feeling at an iron pot to test the powder inside. He brought a pinch to his nose and sniffed it.
This is the flour, he said, breathing in the wholesome, yet somehow still dirty, scent of ground grain. I need about 500 grams.
He took a measuring cup in hand and dipped it in, weighing it by feel, not by sight. He hefted it, then felt for the bowl in his lap and dumped the flour in.
Good, Gran-Gran said.
He mixed it with his hand for a count of 100.
Now oil, he said, raising the proper container to his nose.
He sniffed it, then nodded and tipped it so oil dribbled over his finger into the bowl. She wanted him to measure like that, by touch, of all things. Water followed.
Very good, Gran-Gran said.
She had a patient voice. A voice like a rock would have, he imagined. Immobile, ancient, and thoughtful.
I would rather check to see that I got the amount right, Jorgen said. I didn't really measure anything. Of course you did, she said. not accurately. Mix it. Feel the dough. Does it feel right?
He mixed, his eyes still closed. She refused to let him use an electric mixer. Instead, he mixed by hand, squishing the stretchy dough between his fingers as the ingredients melded.
It, he said, it's too dry. Ah.
She reached out and felt into his bowl.
So it is. So it is. Knead in some water, then.
He did so, still keeping his eyes closed.
You've never peaked,
Gran-Gran noted.
When I taught Spensa to do this, she kept looking through one eye. I had to challenge her to do it without looking, make it a game, before she'd do as I asked.
Jorgen continued kneading. He had given up on trying to figure out how Gran-Gran would know if he'd peaked or not. She was obviously blind. The gnarled old woman had only milky whites for eyes. But there was a power to her. Near her, he felt that same buzzing, fainter than with Spensa or the alien woman.
You never complain, either, Gran-Gran noted. 5 days learning to bake bread by touch, and you've never once asked why I'm making you do this.
I was instructed by my superior officer to come receive your training. I assume it will make sense eventually.
Gran-Gran sniffed at that, as if she wanted him to balk at the strange style of instruction. Well, Jorgen had talked to dozens of soldiers about their first days in training and the monotonous tasks they'd been given. It happened more in the ground crew than in flight school, but he understood nonetheless. Gran-Gran was training him first to accept instruction. He could do that. That made sense. But he wished she'd hurry. On the same day as that first attack, the battleships had made 2 more test barrages at Detritus, and both had been intercepted. Since then, the enemy forces had just sat up there gathering resources, their fleet growing. The Krell's return to inaction had him feeling tense. The Krell had a very large gun to their heads. He needed to learn this new training quickly and ascertain whether he could give the fleet what it needed, then report back to Cobb. That said, he wasn't going to complain. Gran-Gran was effectively now his commanding officer.
Do you hear anything?
Gran-Gran asked as he continued to work the dough.
The buzzing sensation from you, he said, as I reported earlier. It's not really something I hear, though. It's more of an impression, like the vibration you might feel from a distant machine, making the ground tremble.
And if you reach out, like I taught you,
she said,
if you imagine yourself flying through space.
Jorgen tried to do as she said, but it didn't accomplish anything. Just imagining himself floating in space, passing the stars, soaring. He had been there in his ship, and he could picture the experience perfectly. What was it supposed to do?
Nothing, she asked.
Nothing.
No singing, no sense of something far distant calling to you.
No, sir, he said. No, Gran-Gran.
She's out there,
Gran-Gran said, ancient voice cracking as she whispered the words.
And she's worried.
Jorgen snapped his eyes open. He caught a glimpse of Gran-Gran, a wizened old woman who seemed to be all bones and cloth, with powder white hair and milky eyes. She turned her head upward toward the sky. He immediately squeezed his eyes shut.
Sorry, he said. I peeked, but can you feel her?
Yes,
Gran-Gran said softly.
It only happened earlier today. I sensed that she was alive, scared, though she might not admit that even still. Can you get a report on her mission? He asked, dough squeezing through his fingers as he clutched it. Or bring her back?
No.
Gran-Gran said.
Our touch was momentary, fleeting.
I am not strong enough for more. I shouldn't bring her back, even if I could. She needs to fight this fight.
What fight? She's in danger?
Yes. Same as we are. More? Perhaps. Stretch out, Jorgen. Fly among the stars. Listen to them. He tried. Oh, how he tried. He strained with what he thought were the right muscles. He pushed and forced himself to imagine what she'd said. That nothing happened made him feel as if he were letting Spensa down, and he hated that feeling.
I'm sorry, he said. I don't get anything.
Perhaps we should try one of my cousins. He knuckled his hand, pressing it against his forehead, eyes still squeezed closed.
I shouldn't have told her to go. I should have followed the rules. This is my fault.
Gran-Gran grunted.
Back to your dough, she said.
Once he continued kneading, she spoke again.
Have I told you the story of Stanislav, the hero of the Almost War?
The Almost War?
It was back on old Earth, Gran-Gran said,
and he could hear bowls scrape as she began preparing her own dough to bake.
During a time when two great nations had their terrible weapons pointed at one another, and the entire world waited, tense, fearing what would happen if the giants should decide to war.
I know that feeling, Jorgen said, with Krell weapons pointed at us.
Indeed. Well, Stanislav was a simple duty officer, in charge of the sensor equipment that would warn his people if an attack had been launched. His duty was to report immediately if the sensor saw anything.
So his people could get away in time? Jorgen asked.
No, no. These were weapons like the Krell bombers use. Life-ending weapons. There was no escape. Stanislav's people knew that if an attack came from the enemy, they were doomed. His job was not to prevent this, but to provide warning so retaliation could be sent. That way both nations would be destroyed, not just one. I imagine his life to be one of tense quiet, of hoping, wishing, praying, that he never had to do his job. For if he did, it would mean an end to billions. Such a burden.
What burden? Jorgen said. He wasn't a general. The decision wasn't his. He was just an operator. All he had to do was relay information.
And yet, Gran-Gran said softly, he didn't. A warning came in. The computer system said that the enemy had launched. The terrible day had come, and Stanislav knew that if the reading was real, everyone he had ever met, everyone he loved, was as good as dead. Only, he was suspicious. The enemy has launched too few missiles, he reasoned, and this new system has not been tested properly. He debated and he fretted, and then he did not call and tell his superiors what had happened.
He disobeyed orders, Jorgen said. He failed in his most fundamental duty. He kneaded his dough more furiously, pressing it against the base of the wide, shallow bowl.
Indeed, Gran-Gran said. His will was tested, however, as the computer reported another launch, larger this time, though still suspiciously small. He debated. He knew that his duty was to send his people to launch their retaliation, to send death to their enemies while still able. The man and the soldier warred inside him. In the end, he declared the computer's report to be a false alarm. He waited, sweating, until no missiles arrived. That day, he became the only hero of a war that never happened. The man who prevented the end of the world.
He still disobeyed, Jorgen said. It wasn't his job to make the decision he did. It belonged to his superiors. The fact that he was right makes the story justify him in the end, but if he'd been wrong, then he would be remembered as a coward at best, a traitor at worst.
If he'd been wrong, Grangran whispered, he wouldn't have been remembered. For nobody would have lived to remember him.
Jorgen sat back and opened his eyes. He looked down at the firm dough in his hands, then started working it harder, folding it and pushing it, feeling angry for reasons he couldn't explain.
Why are you telling me this story? He demanded of Grangran. Spensa said you always told her stories of people cutting off the heads of monsters.
I told her those stories because she needed them.
So you think I need a story like this? Because I like following orders? I'm not an emotionless machine, Grangran. I helped Spensa rebuild her spaceship. At least, I didn't tell anyone what she was doing when she brought Hurl's booster back, against protocol.
Grangran didn't reply, so Jorgen kept working the dough, smashing it over and over, folding it like the old swordsmiths used to fold metal.
Everyone thinks that just because I like a little structure, a little organization, I'm some kind of alien. Well, excuse me for trying to see that structure exists. If everyone were like this Stanislav, then the military would be chaos. No soldier would fire his gun, out of fear that maybe the order he'd been given was a false alarm. No pilot would fly because who knows, maybe your sensors are wrong and there is no enemy.
He slammed the dough down and sat back against the wall. Grangran grabbed his dough, pressing it between her fingers.
Excellent, she said. Finally some good kneading out of you, boy. That will be some bread.
I
close your eyes, Grangran said.
Jorgen wiped his brow with his sleeve. He hadn't realized how worked up he'd gotten.
Look, maybe I was right to tell Spensa to go, but maybe I shouldn't have. I'm not.
Close your eyes, boy.
He thumped his head back against the wall, but did as she asked.
What do you hear?
Nothing, he said.
Don't be daft. You hear the machinery outside, the apparatus crashing and thudding.
Well, yes, obviously, but
and the people on the street, clamoring home after shift change.
I guess.
And your heartbeat. Do you hear that?
I don't know.
Try.
He sighed, but did as instructed, trying to listen. He could hear it thumping inside him, but probably only because he'd let himself get worked up.
Stanislav wasn't a hero because he disobeyed orders, Grangran said. He was a hero because he knew when to disobey orders. I learned that from my mother, who brought us here, one of her last acts. I think she felt something here, something we needed.
Then I shouldn't be looking toward the stars, Jorgen said, still frustrated. We should be looking at the planet beneath us.
I always wanted to return to the stars, Grangran said.
I like flying, Jorgen said, his eyes still closed. Don't mistake my meaning. At the same time, this is my home. I don't want to escape it, I want to protect it. And sometimes when I'm lying quietly in bed in the deep caverns, I swear that I...
You what? Grangran asked.
Jorgen snapped his eyes open.
I do hear something. But it's not up above us. It's down below.
Chapter 30. I yanked open my backpack, letting a Dione soldier inspect the contents. The inside didn't look suspicious at all, just the large, clear plastic food container that I normally brought my lunches in. It looked perfectly innocent, for all the fact that it was a drone in disguise. The guard shined a small flashlight in at the contents. Would they see how worried I was? Was I sweating too much? Would one of the nearby security drones sense my racing pulse? No, I could do this. I was a warrior,
and sometimes that required craftiness and stealth. I stood there an excruciatingly long moment. Then, bless the stars, the guard waved me forward. I zipped up the pack and shouldered it, hurrying across the shuttle bay of the weights and measures. I tried to exude both confidence and lack of concern.
Alanique? Mortimer asked, stepping up beside me as we entered the hallway. Are you well? Your skin tone looks uncommonly flush.
I didn't sleep well, I said.
We neared the first intersection. Embot suspected that this segment of hallway had a secondary scanner installed to detect illicit materials, but he was confident that the scrambler we'd given the drone would obscure it. Indeed, no alarms went off as we went through the intersection, though a passing Dione crew member did nearly collide with Hesho's small hover platform. Kauri cried out, barely steering the platform around the Dione's head. The crew member apologized and quickly moved on. Kauri flew the platform back, and Hesho's tail twitched in annoyance as he looked over his shoulder at the offending Dione.
Even when we fly, we are underfoot. Serene until marred. A centimeter deep, but reflecting eternity. I am a sea to many, but a puddle to one.
You'd think that the superiority would be accustomed to dealing with people of all sizes, I said.
There aren't many of us, Hesho said. I know of only one other species our size, unless you count the Varvax inside their exoskeletons. Perhaps we will need to build huge suits ourselves. It is difficult for ordinary people in a universe of giants.
His tail twitched again.
But this is the price we must pay